We are here with this episode of an unbranded podcast. We don't really have this regular, but when we have guests on campus, we try to have a little bit of time for conversation and some questions and answers. I'm here today, Wade Mobley, president of the Free Lutheran Bible College and Seminary, with Victor Hembry and Milena Tweet, both of whom are students currently at FLBC, and our guest on campus this week, Nancy Piercy, who is the author of Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality, with earlier books including The Soul of Science, probably my favorite, Saving Leonardo, A Work of Beauty, and Finding Truth, and also two ECPA Gold Medallion Award winners, How Now Shall We Live, co-authored with Harold Fickett and Chuck Colson, and Total Truth. Her books have been translated into 18 languages. She is professor and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University. A former agnostic, Piercy has spoken at universities such as Princeton, Stanford, USC, and Dartmouth. She has been quoted in The New Yorker and Newsweek, highlighted as one of the five top women apologists by Christianity Today, and hailed in The Economist as America's preeminent evangelical Protestant female intellectual. And yes, those are a lot of qualifiers, but if it's coming from The Economist, you know, that's how those things work. So Nancy, it's been great to have you on campus this week. Thank you so much for investing.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you for that. And we'll have a couple of questions here. Milena, why don't we start with you? What did you have for Dr. Piercy?
Well, listening to your talk for the last couple days for Spotlight, you were talking about the fact-value split in the world today and how the spiritual is typically put in the values aspect when it really falls more under the facts aspect. I was just wondering if you would expand on that a little bit to where that falls, yeah.
Yeah, so for people who don't know what the fact-value split is, let's start there. What happened is in the modern age, the concept of truth itself was split. You know, people used to think, you know, there's a single cosmos, you know, there's a moral order and there's a natural order, but they're integrated. And therefore, truth itself would be an integrated, coherent system. But after the rise of modern science, many people began to say, like you, the fact realm, as you put it, that the only thing that's really true, the only place where we really have reliable knowledge is of the realm of empirical facts, what we can see, hear, weigh, and measure. And that put into question, well, what do we do with spiritual and moral truths then? And many people decided, well, they don't even qualify as truths anymore. They're just a matter of personal feelings, personal preference, you know, what gets you through the night. And so this is one of the biggest barriers to communicating Christianity today. It was Francis Schaeffer who first brought this to the attention of evangelical Christians. Like, he was, you know, he had an evangelistic ministry, and he's out of that, he recognized that the main reason that Christians have a difficult time communicating with modern people is that they have this fact-value split in their minds, where they think if you say Christianity is true, they think you just mean, well, it works for me. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives me a sense of meaning to my life. They don't even hear it as an objective truth claim. And so often we have to make a two-step process, and I'll personalize this. This is what my own experience was when I was in the conversion process. When I was a non-Christian, I was considering Christianity. I was already such a relativist that I had to first be persuaded that there was such a thing as objective truth before I could even consider whether Christianity was that truth. And so Francis Schaeffer used to say that with modern people, we almost have to do pre-evangelism. That was one of his favorite terms. Pre-evangelism, you know, before that we give the gospel, we have to explain to them what truth is.
Yeah.
And so to answer your question then, this is why it happens that today when we talk to people about Christianity, they don't even understand what we're talking about. And They're liable to treat it as if you just told them what your favorite flavor of ice cream is.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Oh, I like chocolate. You like vanilla. Oh, that's nice. Great. Glad that works for you. Today, in fact, today they're not even liable to talk about whether Christianity is true or false. They're most likely to say, "Well, good for you. I'm happy it works for you." You know, so you have to get them past that before they even will understand and engage with the claims of biblical truth.
Yeah. So how would you get them past that and lead them to that point?
Yeah. So, well, I probably wouldn't phrase it quite like you did, because you said that people put it in the fact realm, in the value realm, and they should put it in the fact realm. No, we reject the division. Mm-hmm. We reject the division altogether. We don't think there is such a thing as facts that are separate from values. That facts, for one thing, are totally integrated with your overall worldview. Nobody has bare, facts, totally objective. All of our understanding of factual knowledge is integrated into our worldview. And we are not talking about values either, which is, of course, your main point. We are talking about objective truth. So when we're talking to people, the difficulty is not trying to get them into the fact realm. It's to try to get them out of the fact-value split altogether. When I have a class on C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer. I have a Lewis and Schaeffer class at the graduate level at Houston Baptist University. Excuse me, it's now Houston Christian. We're in the process of changing our name.
And never change your name. It's just very, we changed our name a few years ago. I still hear about it, so.
Yeah.
I want to take your class.
We're still in process of changing the name. Anyway, so to be precise, Houston Christian. So yeah, it's a wonderful class. A lot of my students say it's their favorite class because we dig. Lewis and Schaeffer were the two top apologists of the 20th century in terms of the sheer number of people who either were converted through their work or brought through a crisis of faith. And so I tell my students, you should know them for that reason, if nothing else. Like, what made them so successful? What did they do right? So we should definitely know them.
Schaeffer's comment about you cannot invent the world and invent a world and then live in it, and his approach of reductio to take the idea for a test drive, and I can't remember which of the books in the trilogy, but the idea of it's in yours, yeah. But the idea where either Schaeffer would say you're going to drive these people to suicide, and he didn't. But the idea of rejecting that split is going to create a crisis. It's not going to resolve their crisis. It's going to magnify their crisis. But then you can get someplace.
Yes, I thought you've put your finger on what I think is one of the most important parts of Schaeffer's apologetic, which was many people hold bits and pieces of philosophies without actually knowing where they came from and where they lead to. And so one of the things that was so helpful about studying at Labrie was seeing worldviews as coherent wholes, realizing you couldn't pick and choose. It's not cafeteria style. That if you're going to say pick a certain position, you have to realize it's a complete worldview. That's why he used the term worldview a lot, was to say we have to think in terms of complete systems. And so here's an example. I was a complete relativist when I arrived. I didn't even know the term, but I held the concept in the sense that when I was in high school, I remember one particular conversation where a friend was talking about a mutual friend saying, oh, she's so wrong. And I jump in and say, you can't say anyone's wrong. I was the one arguing for moral relativism. When I arrived at Labrie, they said, okay, let's give this a label. There's a word for this. This is called relativism. And then they helped me to see where does relativism come from and where does it lead? Moral relativism, at least in the modern world, often comes from a sort of materialistic or naturalistic worldview. There is no God, there's no supernatural. All we are evolved organisms, products of blind material forces. Well, then of course there's no morality. Any moral concepts we may have are either just social constructs or products of evolution. They worked. They helped the species to survive, but there's no real morality. So I had to realize relativism comes from somewhere. You just can't hold it. And it leads somewhere. Where did it lead to? It leads to that if you can't actually say anyone's right or wrong, then you cannot say Hitler was wrong or Mother Teresa was right. Or as one philosopher puts it, that I quote in that book over there on the table.
Yeah, Finding Truth.
Yeah, one of my books is here on the table, Finding Truth. I quote a philosopher who says, if you're a moral relativist, you will end up being complicit with evil. That you cannot really stand against evil if you're a relativist. And that was what I realized when I was still a student at Labrie, that this is where moral relativism leads, that you will be complicit with evil. You cannot stand against evil. So that's what you just said is exactly right. You lead people to the logical consequences of their ideas and help them to see that it's untenable.
I've got 1,000 questions to ask you about everything, including LaBrie, because you hear about it, but you're a real live LaBrie. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So if we have time, I'll chase that down a little bit. But I want to go to Victor. Victor Hembry, one of our students, has a question about.
Yeah. So I think it's along the same lines as that. I just noticed that many Christians, even in this day and age, we have compartmentalized Christianity, and so we have. It is the fact value split where we compartmentalize Christianity and we say this is where Christianity and church fits in right here, and this is where the rest of my life fits. I think we kind of talked about this with just different business owners who are Christians, mm-hmm. who take what is known about the business world and implement that, and then still have this little Christian idea going on over here, but the two are not connected. The two are not unified. So I've witnessed that in talking to other people about Jesus, but also just in the Christian faith and talking to different Christians. So I guess how do we solve that problem? Because I definitely see it as a problem of we can't tell people about Jesus and that it's a transforming power when they see it as two separate realms.
Oh, yeah, that's really good insight. I agree with you. And in many ways, we started out talking about the fact value split. That's how people talk about it, like in secular academia, for example. That's the secular terminology. But we talk about it, too, in the Christian world. We call it the sacred secular split. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially the same thing. It's essentially saying that there's a sacred realm, and that's where we talk about church and Bible study and prayer meetings and so on. And then there's the secular realm, which is all the rest of life. And many people really don't know how to bring their Christian faith out of this sacred realm and into the so-called secular realm. And I agree with you. It is one reason that we don't have the joy of the Christian life that God promises us. Dorothy Sayers was a friend of C.S. Lewis, and she has a wonderful article called On Work, on our vocation, on our professional jobs. And she said, if Christianity doesn't speak to our work lives, then it doesn't speak to 9/10 of what we do. Mm-hmm. And no wonder people say Christianity is irrelevant. And I love that quote because I agree. How can we show that it's relevant? I think the answer is just backing up and understanding what truth is. When we say Christianity is true, we don't just mean it's true to the spiritual world. We do mean it's true to all of life, all of reality. And I don't think a lot of Christians really grasp that. No, this is true about reality, not some little isolated part of life. It's true about reality. And to some degree, Christians need to retool their very definition of truth. They haven't understood that. And again, since you mentioned LaBrie, wanting to hear more about LaBrie, this was such a strong theme in Francis Schaeffer's own writings, is that Christians themselves have lost the concept of truth. That we do not have a robust, full-orbed concept of what truth is. He used the word worldview a lot, but even that's become a buzzword. Today, people use the word worldview without really knowing what it means. But what he meant by it is that it is a complete system. Christianity is a complete system like any other philosophy. It starts with what is ultimate reality. You've heard it broken down as sort of creation, fall, redemption. Right? Mm-hmm. A lot of us know that. So in a sense, every worldview has to answer creation, fall, redemption. Every worldview has to say, what's the ultimate reality? What is the uncaused cause of everything else? Where does everything start? Where does everything come from? So every worldview, not just Christianity, every worldview starts in a sense with a concept of creation. Every worldview has to deal with a concept of the fall. In other words, what's the source of evil and suffering? And we all know there's evil, suffering, war, and oppression. And so every philosophy, worldview, religion has to have an answer to that question. What is the origin of evil and suffering? And every worldview has to have a notion of redemption, which is what's the solution? How do we fix this? How should we live in a way that overcomes the problem? And so I have had people say to me, those are religious categories, creation, fall, redemption. But actually, they're just simple, ordinary words to describe what in philosophy, you know, you might call metaphysics, epistemology, and so on. You would use these multisyllabic words. But really, every philosophy answers those three questions. And I think if Christians themselves understood that what we have is a complete worldview, just like any other philosophy, I think that Christians would have a renewal of the mind. if we really grasp the concept of truth itself, and then understand that Christianity is that truth.
Do you think that that comes from kind of the idea that we have in culture, that sometimes our philosophies are not something that we can live by? Like in your book, you talk about postmodernism, and if you take it for a test drive, as we talked about, it doesn't really work. You have to have objective truths. If you're going to walk across the street, you're going to check because the car is actually there. It might actually hit you. So do you think that Christianity has kind of taken some of those ideas of, well, this is what we believe when we're sitting around in our white coats, and this is a separate realm that we have to believe for the reality of how we actually live?
Yeah. And again, it's not just a Christian problem. You know, you're the one who has a finding truth on the table in front of you. And finding truth, I have a whole chapter on how secular worldviews are all unlivable. My favorite example probably is Steven Pinker, because he wrote a book. Actually, I quote him in Total Truth, but one of my other books. But he actually has a book called How the Mind Works, which became a bestseller. In other words, you know, this isn't just academic writing. These are influencing real people. It was a best-selling book called How the Mind Works, and what he argued there was that human beings are basically complex data processing machines. Right? So if you're an evolutionist, if you're a materialist, and you reduce people just matter, you deny that there's anything beyond the material, there's no mind, spirit, soul, you know, the cutting edge today is there's not even consciousness, you know, that consciousness itself is an illusion. And that's why Steven Pinker says we're basically complex data processing machines. And then he literally says in that book, but when we take off our white coats, you know, as scientists, and go home for the day, we cannot... We can't treat our wife and kids like complex data processing machines. You know, at least we better not.
Yeah.
And he literally says, we go back to treating one another as dignified, free and dignified human beings. That was his exact words. It's like, what? Wait a minute. You're admitting that your own philosophy that you work with professionally and in the lab doesn't work in the real world. And I had a fascinating experience once. I was giving examples like this in a talk, in a public lecture once. Steven Pinker was my key example because he actually says ethics requires us to believe in something that our science tells us is not true. In other words, ethics requires us to believe in freedom, right? That we have moral freedom, that we can make real choices. Otherwise, why are we responsible? So he says ethics requires us to believe in free will. But our science tells us we're just complex machines operating by blind material forces. And he ends up saying, well, when we're playing the ethics game, you know, we use one language. And when we're playing the science game, we use a different language. At any rate, so I was in a public lecture where I was giving examples like this. Unbeknownst to me, there was a Harvard physics professor in the room. And he came storming up to me afterwards and was furious because I had given examples, and some of them were his colleagues at Harvard, giving examples of people who admitted that they can't live with their worldview outside of the lab. And he said, these guys know that their philosophy doesn't work outside the lab, that it doesn't work in the real world, but why throw it in their faces? And I was so stunned, I hardly had an answer, because he admitted two things. He admitted that they knew that their materialist, reductionist philosophy doesn't work outside the real world. You can't treat people as complex data processing machines. But then he had characterized my critique as throwing it in their faces. I don't see it that way. I see it as helping you think through the logical implications of your worldview. Mm-hmm. And that's helpful. You know, we should think through, where does my worldview lead? And if it leads to the, you use the word reduction to the absurd.
Yeah.
You know, if it leads to consequences that you can't live with, this is good to know, because it's a way of saying, if my worldview doesn't fit the real world, then maybe I should go back to the drawing board. I mean, this was my own experience. Again, my time at La Brie, this is the kind of thought process I had to go through as a non-Christian when I realized that my worldview, for example, I was one of those who believed in complete determinism. You know, my science classes had taught me, again, that we are products of evolution, you know, or products of blind automatic material forces, and therefore there's no free will. And when I realized, well, that doesn't work in the real world, you know, we make choices from the moment we wake up in the morning. There's a philosopher at USC, John Searle, and he says, if you don't believe in free will, then the next time you go to a restaurant, you should say to the waitress or the waiter, just bring me whatever the laws of nature have determined I will get. So when I realized it, my worldview didn't work in the real world, I did. I thought, okay, in that case, I better find a worldview that does. You know, if we inherently, you know, we can't not make choices, if you can understand the double negative. Yes. There. We cannot not make choices. And therefore, if our worldview doesn't support that, we better go back to the drawing board and find one that does. And that's what made me open to Christianity, because I realized, okay, Christianity does fit the real world in a way that my atheist philosophy doesn't.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's great. So much there. In finding truth, and I have used Total Truth in Apologetics and Christian Thought and excerpts from it, because it's a little, there's a little more to that volume. But in finding truth, it's a little more linear, and it really drives towards a point. And the students appreciate that, I think. but the parts of that book that stood out to me and that I've kept repeating in class is nothing but and as if. You know, the reductionistic nature of idolatry, and that every worldview has its mystics. Maybe you can comment on that a little bit. I think it's very helpful.
Yeah. Well,
it's also very simple.
And it ties into what we've been talking about. So every non-Christian worldview will be reductionistic in one way. So reductionism means that you reduce reality to some lower level of status. So, and that's the nothing but. Reductionism is sometimes called nothing buttery. but the argument I make in Finding Truth is that every non-Christian worldview will be reductionistic. And that's what's a little bit unique about this, because Christian philosophers have dealt with this philosophy or that philosophy. And when I first became a Christian, because I had been an atheist before, I felt this incredible responsibility to understand all the opposing views and all possible objections and have an answer for all of them. And I realized that would take a lifetime. You know, that was impossible. But in Finding Truth, what I realized is that once you understand certain principles, you don't have to memorize answers for every possible worldview out there. And the principle is Romans 1. Mm-hmm. The principle is, as Paul says in Romans 1, if you do not believe in the transcendent creator of the universe, Paul says, you will exchange the glory of God. You will exchange that by worshiping something in the creation, something in the created order. And of course, back then, it was usually something concrete like a golden calf, you know. But today it can be something abstract as well, right? So a lot of the idols that people live for, like career success, you know, relationships, you know, achievement and so on. But it can also be isms. So naturalism and materialism are probably the most common on the university campus today, so I like to focus on them. But materialism says all that exists is matter. Well, in that case, what you have essentially put matter in the place of God, because you've said the ultimate reality, the uncaused cause of everything else, you know, that thing, you know, that has produced everything else is matter. Well, that's putting matter in the place of God. So that qualifies as an idol in Paul's definition.
So existence then becomes nothing but matter, energy, information.
Not information.
Not even information. Okay. It's baked in there someplace.
Well, yeah. The questions about DNA, we're having to argue for information, actually.
Yes. Well, that's the Anthony Flew. I can't do materialism because of information.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But at any rate, matter and energy. And so human beings themselves are reduced to just nothing but, matter and energy, or as people often will say today, complex biochemical machine. Mm-hmm. So that's the nothing but part. Every worldview out there will take something in the created order and reduce everything else to that one dimension. And that's the idol in Romans 1. But nobody can live with it. This is the Harvard physics professor who came up and said, why throw it in their faces? They know their worldview doesn't fit the real world, but why throw it in their faces? Well, because they should be critical thinkers. That's why we bring it up, because we want them to realize that if you are having to live as if your worldview were not true, that's a key sign that your worldview is not fitting the real world. So many of these thinkers will write, I have several quotes in Finding Truth. I was astonished at how many people I could find who would say, well, everything is, we're just mechanisms, the universe is a vast machine, and we're just part of the machine. But we live as if we had free will. We live as if love and relationships were real, and not just chemical reactions in the brain. The one that my students remember the most is Rodney Brooks. So he's at MIT. None of these are fringe characters, right?
No.
So, Steven Pinker, who I mentioned earlier, is now at Harvard. Rodney Brooks, MIT. So we're not talking about, fringe characters. These are leading figures. Rodney Brooks was the is emeritus now at MIT, but he was the head of their artificial intelligence lab, and he wrote a book called Flesh and Machines, in which he says, I'm a materialist, I'm an evolutionist, and therefore I do believe people are just machines. And then he says, I know it's hard to see people this way, but when I look at my children, if I really try hard, I can see that they are machines. I mean, this is a direct quote. If I really try, I can see that my children are just machines. And then the next sentence is, do I treat them that way? Of course not. I don't treat them as machines. They have my unconditional love. And then he literally says, I realize that this is irrational within my own worldview. Because in my worldview, love is just neurons firing in the brain, chemical reactions. And therefore, loving my children is irrational within my own worldview. And you say, well, how does he live with that then? How can you live with that kind of internal contradiction? This is the as if. How can you live as if your children were not machines when your worldview says they are? And this is another direct quote. He literally says, I maintain two sets of inconsistent beliefs. So he acknowledges that in order to live in the real world, he has to live as if his worldview were not true. And by the way, the apologetic side of this comes in. He has to live as if Christianity mm-hmm. were true.
Freeloading atheist.
The freeloading atheist. And by the way, that's a phrase by an atheist.
Yeah.
I did not invent that. But that was freeloading atheist is a term that was used by an atheist who said, I cannot live according to my own worldview. And so I have to live as if Christianity were true. In other words, we have to live as if we were creatures who have free will and can make moral choices. We have to live as if love were real, even, love for our children, like Rodney Brooks says, I have to live it. They have my unconditional love, even though that's irrational in my worldview. I have to live as if it were true. What he's saying is I have to live as if Christianity were true. Because it's Christianity that gives the basis for treating people as if they're made in the image of God and not products of blind material forces of evolution.
Could I talk to you just a little bit about, I want to talk about LaBrie and CLBS just a little bit. So can we start with LaBrie? I have this picture reading Schaefer. Probably discovered him in my 20s. I was converted to Christ when I was 18. engineering student, engineering physics, actually, and coached basketball. That was my double major. And then I ended up here to study the Bible for 2 years and have self-trained philosophy all the way through. And so my time in Strasbourg was kind of to just double check and make sure that, you know, Hitler was self-trained. You know, I wanted to make sure not to. Anyway, so Schaeffer's, you know, the trilogy is where I got started. But I had this picture of Le Brie. Lower altitude Swiss Alps, because there's trees in my head, kind of a cross between Grizzly Adams and The Shire, with Edith Schaeffer boiling something on the stove and mattresses on the floor like a crash pad, and Francis Schaeffer smoking a pipe and a gray beard. And I don't know if he smoked a pipe, and talking to these poor students who are coming off of bad LSD acid trips. That's my picture of Le Brie. And you were there. Please correct my mental image.
Yeah, I like to explain how it started, because Francis Schaeffer, well, he was sent to Europe first by Child Evangelism Fellowship to assess the state of the churches after World War II.
I had no idea. I didn't know that. CEF.
Yeah. And so he went back, gave his report, and they said, "We think you should go back and fix it." So he went back. He went back to Europe and settled in Switzerland. And he was really a true evangelist at heart, by the way. I heard him at a conference once where somebody asked him, "Are you a philosopher or a theologian?" And he said, "I'm an evangelist." Mm. And I agree with that. But so he was... So he spoke all around Europe and so on. But he had three daughters who went down the Alps, went down to the university in Lausanne, Switzerland. And they began talking to their friends. And that when their friends had questions about God, they would say, "Well, you should talk to my dad. He's really good with questions like that." And so they would take the little train up the mountain. And because it was so inaccessible, they would just spend the weekend, you know. And then they'd go down the mountain and tell their friends. And another group of students would come out, and, you know, another group of students would come up. And over time, there were kids sleeping on the balconies and on the floors and on the couches, and like you said, everywhere. And that's how it sort of grew organically into a ministry where people come and actually stay. And the reason that's important is because they had a twofold ministry. Francis Schaeffer was really good at evangelism and apologetics, but he might have been just one more talking head if it weren't for the fact that people actually came and lived in his home. Mm-hmm. And so they experienced Christian community. And the way Le Brie grew, by the way, is that so they lived in a chalet, which sounds like a luxury home, but no, yeah. That's just what people live in the Swiss Alps. You know?
Yeah.
Farmers live in chalets.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So people would convert, through Le Brie, and they'd say, "I'd like to be part of this ministry." So they would buy a chalet down the street, and someone else would buy a chalet across the village. And so Le Brie was just a little collection of chalets sprinkled through a small Swiss farming village.
Wow.
That's really all it was. So people would come, but they wanted to reproduce the experience of actually living with a family. And so a lot of people said that when they became Christians was that it was not just the apologetics that was persuasive. It was also experience of quality of Christian community that they'd never known before, that they had not known, say, back home. And I would say the same thing for me. Yeah, it was very persuasive to experience that kind of Christian community. Hmm. It gave reality to what Schaeffer was saying. You know, it wasn't just words. You could see, if a Christian celebrity flies in for a conference and speaks on a podium, you know, he can sound really impressive. But what is he really like in person, you know, with his family and with his staff? Well, with Schaeffer, we saw it. We saw him day by day.
There was no place to hide.
There was no place to hide. And so I can tell you, he was authentic. He was real.
So there's something, there's a takeaway on that, that the idea of that if your worldview is being reduced to the absurd, that best is paired with hospitality.
That's a good point. Yes, you know, you mentioned earlier that people might commit suicide. Yes, there were a lot of people at Le Brie who reached the point of despair, like realizing that their non-Christian worldview did not work. And so it was a very delicate thing. How do you deal with people who are realizing that My own worldview does not give me meaning or purpose. My own worldview doesn't give me a sense of who I am. As you know, Christianity says we're made in God's image, gives you great dignity and value, whereas you're realizing that your secular worldview doesn't. That's an important turning point, and you're right, it's very delicate. So being surrounded by a supportive community, I like the way you put it. That's a big part of the process.
Could I jump
yeah,
in?
Yeah, sure, Melena.
And that's through like living honestly as a Christian, like you talked about as well, like living out that Christian life that you're saying that you have. So you don't just have like your word saying that you're living your Christian life, but then you have those secular ideas in your mind and are living that out. But instead you're actively pursuing God and actively seeking him and then living that out. And other people see that, whether you think they do or not.
Yes, exactly. It's very visible. I mean, after I became a Christian, and I became familiar with Christian celebrities who can fly in and sound good. It has helped me to appreciate LaBrie more now, I think, than I did it. Well, at the time, when I first arrived, I was 19. You know, I did not have a basis for comparison. I actually went to LaBrie twice. Did you realize that?
No, I didn't. But when you flashed up that slide, the picture from 1971, and they said you were 19, I mean, most of us can do enough math. Anyway, but I didn't know you were there twice.
Yeah, yes. So, because I didn't become a Christian the first time.
It didn't, yeah. Sometimes it takes a buildup.
Well, the background is, you know, I was raised in the Lutheran church. and I had asked my questions as a teenager and nobody could answer them. And so Christianity had let me down. I mean, I was not happy because Christianity had let me down. It had not answered my questions. And so when I walked away from my faith, it was very intentional and I did not want to go back. And people sometimes ask me, why did you go to LaBrie then? You know, if you were not a Christian, why would you go to Christian ministry? Actually, the reason I went there is because I had some family traveling through and they decided to stop at LaBrie just for a weekend, kind of a touristy, kind of a touristy attitude. Let's see what's happening at LaBrie. And they stayed for a weekend and they said, hey, you know, I was living in Germany. I should say that. I was living in Germany because we had lived in Germany when I was a kid. And I had wanted to go back. So I was in Germany. And so when these family members stopped in Switzerland at LaBrie, they said, hey, come down and see us. So I went to LaBrie to see my family, not to go to LaBrie.
Not to go to LaBrie. There you go. Oh, that's funny.
And when I was there, it was quite obvious that I was not a Christian because of the questions I asked. And they said, and the staff said, hey, you have a lot of questions. Would you like to stay? Because that's how it was back then.
Wow.
It was not highly structured. It was, you know, hey, some needy kid comes through, you know, like you said, on drugs, which was the case a lot at the beginning, or in my case, just a lot of questions. And if they had a free bed, they'd say, you want to stay? And I thought, you know, I think I will. I've never met Christians like this before.
Yeah.
But because it was so appealing, I had never met Christians who could answer my questions, who could engage with the secular philosophies that I had totally imbibed by that time. The cultural apologetics was appealing. I was coming there from Germany where I was studying at the Heidelberg Conservatory because I'm a violinist. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that Schaeffer was also sensitive to the arts, you know, that's one of the things he's known for, was encouraging the arts, which is why his form of apologetics is called cultural apologetics. And then finally, as you saw from that photo that I put up on the slide, they were all hippies.
Yeah.
And at that time, that was really quite unique. And I did think, who are these Christians that they can, you know, talk to hippies? And so Christianity was so appealing. The form of Christianity that I was seeing at LaBrie was so appealing that I was afraid I might be drawn in emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do that because Christianity had already let me down once and I was not going to be fooled again.
Yeah.
That's how I felt. And so I stayed only a month the first time and I left because I was afraid I might become a Christian.
Wow. Wow.
But through LaBrie, I discovered there was such a thing as apologetics. And so I kept reading, you know, Schaeffer, of course. That's when I learned about C.S. Lewis, G.K. Chesterton, and others. And
Chesterton's the guy that everybody quotes and nobody's read. But Orthodoxy, I've introduced some of my students to Orthodoxy. I was probably 30 years old when I read Orthodoxy. Where has this been all my life? It's amazing.
Yes. And so just through my own reading, I became a Christian. And then I thought, well, where do I find other Christians? Because I wasn't in a church or anything. I didn't have Christian friends. I was totally on my own. And so I thought, oh, well, I knew some back at LaBrie. So I went back a year and a half later. Mm. And that's when I stayed 4 months. Most students end up many countries have 3 month tourist visas. And so that's a lot of people would go to LaBrie for 3 months. It's kind of a semester thing. So that's when I really got grounded in Christian worldview, was on the second time around.
Fantastic. I'm going to hang up on one more question here, and that is having to do with California Lutheran Bible School. Okay, a little bit of background for those listening. Free Lutheran Bible College was Association Free Lutheran Bible School, which was originally Free Lutheran Bible School, 1964. And we were part of the LBI, Lutheran Bible Institute movement, back when everybody had Bible institutes, and there were 1,000 of them. You know, Moody, of course, and Biola, and those places really grew. Many of them are just gone now or have become larger institutions, more or less Christian or not. But CLBS was in California, and a number of people early in our denomination's history went there. So people like Al Munson, Mike Brandt, Eldon Nelson, Dave Jory, some of these names they went there. And several of them were converted to Christ at a revival in 1965 in rural Lake Preston, South Dakota, where I'm from. And some of the people from that revival started our church, where I first heard the gospel from anybody other than my mom, in 1987. It was kind of a ELCA merger church. They were staying out of the merger, and this is where it was. And so I was always curious about this and started doing some research on it, about this revival and the LBI movement. It's just become precious to me, and we're a little different manifestation of that, but we're the one other than Camrose, Alberta, that still remains. So that said, California Lutheran Bible School, our connection in Lake Preston with Theodore Hax, who died in the late summer of 1965, taught prophecy. I mean, straight up premillennial, dispensational, Cold War, you know, eschatology, and other things. Yeah, you know, it was an awkward era, but I've got the audio. But anyway, CLBS, California Lutheran Bible School, great history. It's no longer in existence. But tell us about your time there, and especially that little connection to the founding of it.
Yeah. So the longest story, which I'll try to keep short.
Sure.
The longest story is I became a Christian. It was after my second time at LaBrie. I came home, and some friends took me to hear Bill Gothard.
Yeah.
You remember Bill Gothard?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was it. We were still speaking of awkward times in American Christianity. So.
But he said, one of the things he said is, you know, young people need to reconcile with their parents. Well, a lot of young people do need to reconcile with their parents. Yeah. And he talked about doing one thing that would show that your parents that you intended to reconcile. So I thought, okay, I'll do that. Well, the one thing that my parents always wanted us to do was to go to Bethany Lutheran College, because that was a family school for my mom's side of the family.
Okay.
And the Norwegian side.
Yeah.
The Norwegian side of the family. You know, all my aunts and uncles and cousins all went to Bethany Lutheran College.
And that's
College.
New Ulm, right?
No, Minnesota. No, where? Mankato.
Oh, Mankato. Excuse me. Oh, I did my ELS, my ELS Wells. I get those things mixed up, and that'll get you shot. If you're in the wrong conference. Anyway, so Mankato, just down the road to Mankato, yeah.
Mankato, right. I mean, ever since we were young, they wanted us to go to this Lutheran school, and there were six of us kids, and we were all like, are you kidding? We are never going to that Lutheran school. that was our perspective. So I thought, okay, I'll show my parents I want to reconcile by doing something they've always wanted. While I was there, I heard about CLBS, okay. California Lutheran Bible School, because the really committed kids were going to go to CLBS. Mm. And that was those were the ones I hung out with, because, you know, I was a new convert. And so I had sort of that new convert zeal that not all the students there had.
Yeah. You know?
So that's what made me decide to go. I was living in New Mexico at the time. I drove out to L.A. to CLBS, and I arrived on the front doorstep, and I gave my name, which was Nancy Randolph. And they said, are you related to Pastor Randolph? And I was totally puzzled, because I said, well, I do have a grandfather, and he was a pastor. And it turned out he was a key figure in that LBI movement. He had taught at in the Minneapolis LBI. He had taught at the Seattle LBI. And he was really considered like one of their heroes. And I had no idea. My father was so estranged from his father that I knew nothing about this. I knew nothing about his connection to the Bible school movement. I mean, that was his heart. It turns out that really was his heart. He was a pastor too, but he was a teacher at heart, and he loved the Bible school. At any rate, and when even when I told my parents I was going out to CLBS, you know, there's this Bible school out in L.A. that I'm going to go. They're like, okay, bye. They didn't say anything. And so it was a huge shock to find out that I had this heritage. My own grandfather had been so much a part of that movement. And it was like opening up this huge heritage that I had no idea I had, which was wonderful. You know, that I would stumble upon such a rich heritage that was my own family was a real gift from God.
Well, we have bestowed upon you the honorific friend of FLBCS, and you've been just such a blessing to us. So thank you for your writing and your work, your gracious manner as well. It's attractive, and I think it really helps our students dive in. They really enjoyed it, and it's been a good time. So thank you so much for being here, Dr. Nancy Piercy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Milena and Victor, thank you very much. And producer Luke Quambeck behind the microphone, thank you so much. And we will see you next time.